It's 11:05. Welcome back to the program. Coming up at 11:35, we will be talking about Victoria Park. There's a bit of a problem with contaminated syringes in the park, and that news has been making its rounds. We'll be talking about that at 11:35. This is something very interesting, forwarded to me by producer Neil Adams. The ozone layer that shields life from the sun's cancer-causing ultraviolet rays is showing its first sign of thickening after years of dangerous depletion, according to a UN study. Now, experts said it showed the success of a 1987 ban on man-made gases that damage the fragile high-altitude screen, an achievement that would help prevent millions of cases of skin cancer and other conditions. The ozone hole that appears annually over Antarctica has also stopped growing bigger every year, though it will be about a decade before it starts shrinking, is said the report co-produced by the World Meteorological Organization and the UN Environment Program. Now, past studies have suggested the ozone layer has stopped getting worse. And the article was a very, very interesting read. Here to help us out with this one is Dr. Hind Alabadle, who is associate professor at the Department of Chemistry at Wilfrid Laurier University. Good morning, doctor. How are you?
Very well. How are you? All right.
I'm doing very well. Now, you wrote an article as well, which I found very interesting, and it was on the recovery of the ozone layer. And you say that you were very pleased with all the headlines back on September 10th.
Yes, definitely. This was like great news for scientists who have been following the recovery of the ozone layer and the connection to greenhouse gases. Last week, two reports came, the one that you mentioned in your introduction about the recovery of the ozone layer, and the other one that was a little darker because it reported actually higher concentrations of CO2 building up in the 2012 and 2013, more than the 1984 year. So, but focusing on the good news, basically the recovery of the ozone layer has been exciting because it actually shows that when countries come together and sign an international treaty, that's the Montreal Protocol, then, nature can recover and we could see things coming back the way they should.
There's been so much discussion over the years about climate change. There has been so much discussion. And, we say climate change now, but at first it was global warming, right? I mean, that's how everybody kind of got around to the idea of climate change, was because of, the idea of global warming. And why is it better or more accurate to call it climate change as opposed to global warming?
Yeah, this is a very important thing. So global warming came into the mainstream because, concentrations of CO2 going up were correlated with temperatures, surface temperature and atmospheric temperature also going up. So that was an easier thing to actually tell the people about, that, these two things are related. But then over the years, when countries started to invest in research to monitor changes to the biosphere, to what happens to the oceans, it turns out that also rising CO2 levels also cause ocean acidification. And it also causes or changes weather patterns, and that can result in severe thunderstorms or droughts in some areas and flooding in other areas. So it turns out that it's, to talk about only temperature was actually telling less than half the story, and the full story will include the oceans, will include the flooding, will include weather patterns. So it's more accurate to describe it as a global climate change because it will encompass all of what I just told you.
Is climate change a cycle? Does the Earth go through cycles, or are we talking about man-made stuff?
Okay, so definitely this is a question that, people have looked into that. And so natural change, the Earth climate does go through natural cycles. Mm-hmm. And what we have learned from the natural behavior of how, the climate correlates with the carbon dioxide concentrations and all of that is that before the Industrial Revolution, the cycles were predictable, and they were called cycles because they will dip to the minimum level and they will just, come up to a higher level. And we only have seen, but then these cycles take tens of thousands of years, right? So the man-made term that is, or what we call human-induced climate change, that is coming into effect since the past 200 years. This is something humanity did not see before. Neither the data tells us so, and that's why we're trying to figure out, you know, how to deal with it, because this is 200 years in geological terms is very short time, very short.
Right.
So this is where the human influence comes into play. Nature doesn't work that way. Nature has its own time to recover from catastrophes, to recover from volcano eruptions, for example. But when humans are causing or are playing a factor in changing these patterns, things happen faster, and nature doesn't have the capacity to actually deal with an influence that's happening on a much faster rate.
Mm-hmm.
You
know, it's very interesting when you mentioned earlier the fact that, you know, when governments get together and sign international treaties that, you know, monitor that study that, you know, for example, the 1987 Montreal Protocol, as you mentioned, you know, that banned phased out ozone depleting chemicals. You know, I was reading this morning that you know, that would prevent something like 2 million cases of skin cancer annually by 2030. That is tremendous. That's a tremendous number.
That's right. That's right. And the other significant thing is that Antarctica, you know, the ozone hole happens over Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
And it did not happen over a single country or multiple countries who were, like, trying to call upon other countries to help them out with this problem. This ozone hole was happening over the South Pole, yet it got so big that the southern borders of Australia, New Zealand, and South America, this is where people live. You see what I mean? And that's why they said, you know, if the hole is getting bigger to the degree that it's reaching out to land that's occupied by humans and by animals, then you know, we need to do something about it. And then all countries, even those who were not affected by the ozone hole, came together and showed solidarity and signed the treaty. And it basically shows a degree of responsibility to our actions. And it worked because the Montreal Protocol actually have done two positive things. One of which is banning the substances that will deplete ozone. But the other thing too is that these substances that deplete ozone are actually more powerful greenhouse gases than carbon dioxide. And by signing the Montreal Protocol, we actually have slowed down human-induced climate change or global warming because we have limited the growth in the concentration of chemicals that could be even more, you know, more harmful than CO2.
Dr. Hind Alabadley on the line, associate professor in the Department of Chemistry at Wilfrid Laurier University on the line with us this morning. So right now, as these studies suggest, or at least the good one suggests, that it has stopped getting worse. It isn't shrinking, though, right? It's just not expanding anymore.
Yes, that's the issue, right? So basically, the monitoring of ozone concentrations during its minimum levels during the winter and spring times over Antarctica shows that you know, they're starting to climb up. Right. So basically, just to give you numbers here, in the 70s, numbers will be around 200 Dobson units, which is a unit to give you an idea about how much ozone you have there. And now they dip down to 100 units. So that's half of the 1970s. So now we're seeing that, you know, that dip, I think we're on track to actually going up. So the minimum concentrations that we're going to see will be above that 100 level, 100 Dobson units level. But, you know, so this is very, very good. Ideally, without influence for climate change, scientists have predicted that by 2050, we will see the complete recovery of the ozone layer. However, there are still questions on the impact of climate change on the ozone concentrations in the stratosphere, because we have to keep in mind that the troposphere, which is the layer of the atmosphere that's closest to the Earth's surface, any changes in the temperature in that layer will affect temperature in the layer above it, which is the stratosphere where the ozone layer is.
Could we be doing more to speed up the process? What more can we be doing to kind of get to that mark? As you mentioned, 2050, could we speed up that process?
Right. So I think there are two things that we could do. The substitutes to chlorofluorocarbons or to CFCs are by themselves, greenhouse gases. So now the challenge to chemists and engineers is that how can we manufacture chemicals that will actually be ozone friendly and also will be less potent greenhouse gases. That's one thing. The other thing, too, is that we need to decarbonize. We need, we are now at a stage in our human evolution with this, existential problem that we need to deal with. We have to acknowledge that climate change is happening and that scientists have shown multiple lines of evidence that it is. So we really should not concern ourselves with or ask the question of is it happening or not. It is happening and we're witnessing impacts. I think to move forward, we need to talk about adaptation and mitigation. We need to think about how we can transition to a low-carbon economy. We need to think of a new lifestyle, basically, that could be that will involve, energy efficiency, energy conservation, thinking about how we can, back off, basically, from mm-hmm. nature and help it recover.
Right. And it's so interesting because you just mentioned that we shouldn't be having the conversation whether it's happening or not. We should be looking forward and looking ahead. But I did want to ask you, why do you think that there is opposition to this, right? I mean, I've already received an email that says basically that this is just more squandering from the UN, that, they're just looking to suck more money out of things. I mean, I wonder why there is so much opposition to this. Do you think it's just about education?
Definitely education. There is also an element of fear of the future because we're talking about something that we have not dealt with before, and it is something that is really affecting our lifestyle, our way of life. In the industrialized nations, we live a very comfortable life. And when you tell people that, and it's a carbon intense lifestyle, this whole carbon intense lifestyle is dangerous to the planet. It's like, what do you want me to do? I mean, I enjoy my life. I like my life. So it's hard for people who are, I think, not, have been really blessed by not really feeling the impact as hard as flooding in the Philippines, for example, or the droughts in California. When it doesn't hit your backyard, it's very hard to actually think about it rationally. But I think we really need to change that because, the droughts in California, for example, I'm very concerned about them because if you go out to the grocery stores and just read where your food comes from, you'll see a lot of our food in Ontario comes from California throughout the year. So when something happens in California and they are witnessing the worst drought ever, then you should be concerned. What's happening in California is affecting me here in Ontario.
Right.
When things, so this is something that will hit your bread basket, So I think we just need to think about it in those terms, our carbon intense lifestyle was good for some time, but we need to actually now think more like, responsible citizens who can say that, my actions are having consequences and impacts, and they need to think differently about the future. And just think about it really rationally and try to, because there are solutions. There are solutions out there, energy efficiency, energy conservation, investment in renewables, in low carbon.
Living local, too. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Living local, eating local, supporting our farmers, all of these things that you'll see yourself saving money as well. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Like when you adopt an environmentally friendly lifestyle, you end up saving money and you end up having good relationships with the farmers that provide food for you. So it is doable. We have solutions. We just need to look at the solutions and not bother with the noise out there.
and you know what? And there's a lot of noise out there. And, Doctor, you're like a pro because that's a perfect segue. We will be talking about the Live Local KW Challenge that started yesterday. It's running through this week. Juliana Gomez, the founder of Live Local KW, will be joining me on the program at 12:35, where it challenges people for this entire week to, live eat, play locally. So that's a perfect segue into that. You're like a pro, Doctor. Thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Dr. Hind Alabadle right there, who is an associate professor in the Department of Chemistry at Wilfrid Laurier University. So this is, largely because of the Montreal Protocol of 1987 that banned or phased out ozone-depleting chemicals. And finally, a good news story where the ozone layer doesn't seem to be getting any bigger, and we could actually be on track, thanks largely to that 87 Montreal Protocol, to start shrinking the ozone layer, which could prevent 2 million cases of skin cancer annually by 2030, according to the study. Do you think that more attention should be paid to the environment? Do you think that more attention should be paid to climate change by both ourselves and the governments? Numbers are coming your way. We'll take your calls and emails straight ahead on Rogers TV and 570 News.
When humans are playing a factor in changing these patterns, things happen faster, and nature doesn't have the capacity to actually deal with an influence that's happening on a much faster rate.
570 Midday continues with Eric Drozd.
All right, welcome back. 11:24 here on 570 News Midday. That is Dr. Hind Alabadle, an associate professor in the Department of Chemistry at Wilfrid Laurier. And we're talking about the 1987 Montreal Protocol that banned or phased out ozone-depleting chemicals. And lo and behold, some good news last week where the ozone layer that shields life from the sun's cancer-causing ultraviolet rays is showing its first signs of thickening after years of dangerous depletion, according to a UN study. And Dr. Alabadle wrote in response to that, saying how excited and pleased she was to hear some of the headlines, because it's actually some good news. And a lot of this is because of that 1987 protocol, the Montreal Protocol, that, again, phased out a lot of these chemicals. The study says that this could prevent 2 million cases of skin cancer annually by 2030. So definitely some good news. Phone lines are open. Do you feel like there needs to be more education when it comes to climate change? Do you feel like governments need to be paying more attention to climate change? 519-570-2545 locally, because there are people out there that will say that it's all fabricated and that, you know, and as the doctor said, there's a lot of noise out there, a lot of information circling around that, quite frankly, isn't true. I mean, you can only ask Richard Zorosky when we have him on for the Science Files Thursdays at noon, you know, and he'll laugh at it, right? And because there's so much noise out there, so much misinformation can get out there on the internet. And I think it makes it so much more difficult to weed out and to swim through to get some of the fact-based, you know, science that is out there and what we know. 519-570-2545, locally, out of town, 1-800-570-5715, star 570 by cell. The email is eric at 570news.com. It is 11:26. Coming up at 11:35, Melissa Y will be joining me. She's a concerned Victoria Park resident. We have had an issue of contaminated syringes being a bit of a problem in Victoria Park. A number of residents living there are concerned. The community has lobbied against provincial governments, local and provincial government officials, to address the problem or at least make people aware of the potential danger. But at this point, no one, as I understand it, has taken responsibility. And we're talking about things like, you know, syringes and other drug paraphernalia and other things being found in Victoria Park all the time. So that's coming up at 11:35 here on Rogers TV and 570 News. Did I miss something in that story that Arlene Dowell just read during the newscast? That was a goldfish story, right?
Yeah. Normally I've got something witty to say.
Hang on a second. I mean, I heard 10 to 20 years. Goldfish live that long?
I am speechless. I got nothing.
We need to investigate to see if this was a goldfish, if I heard correctly, because apparently it had a tumor and now the veterinarian has removed it and said that it bought George the goldfish. An extra 10 or 20 years into it. Goldfish live that long? I thought it was like, 5, maybe 6 years tops. I don't know.
I feel terrible about all of the short lifespans of the goldfish that I had growing up.
Slow news day, I guess, in ABC world. I don't know. But hey, good news story. That's two good news stories right in a row. All right. So this is something that has been in the news here locally. And a resident brought this to my attention via Twitter, and producer Neil Adams had this brought to his attention as well by a concerned resident. We're talking about the issue of syringes being located around Victoria Park. Apparently, there's quite a few of them that are being found, and it has a lot of people living in the Victoria Park neighborhood concerned. And there was a story in the Record some months ago about one particular resident's dog stepping on one of the syringes, and I mean, we could all agree that it could be unsafe. Joining me on the line right now is Melissa Y, who is a concerned Victoria Park neighborhood resident. Hi, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well. This is something that, you know, as I mentioned, has been in the news. And you find syringes often in Victoria Park?
Very often. Just about daily if you walk around the park, especially in the morning.
Really?
Because there are some residents who are out there cleaning them up every day. But if you stand on a bridge and you look in the lake, you'll find them near the new bathrooms. Some days there's as few as two, and some days you can see as many as 30 on the floor. Out behind the new bathrooms, up on the hill, by the clock tower, and even in the little grove of trees where in the summer we have free yoga classes in the park, you can find them in there too. Like there, it's that whole section near the clock tower, between the clock tower and the bathrooms, can be quite bad.
How long have you been finding these syringes for? I mean, is this something that, has been going on for years, or is this particularly become bad now?
We moved downtown just over 2 years ago. So it was really about 2 years ago that I started visiting the park just about every day. And so that's when I personally started seeing them. I've heard that it's been an issue for longer, and that the biggest problem used to be in the boathouse and in the washrooms there. And that's why a lot of people advocated for separate bathrooms for the park to be put in, because the owner of the boathouse, Kevin, was having to clean up this mess in the boathouse bathrooms. And so since the boathouse has closed, it's become worse in the rest of the park.
And now we have residents such as yourself and others that are cleaning up, as you mentioned, every day.
Mm-hmm.
And have you contacted city officials or the region with your concern?
I have several times, and it's a real runaround. When I first started making calls, I called Aqua because I figured they're the ones that are giving out the needles in the needle exchange program. So I called them, and they told me that cleaning up the needles is not part of their mandate, that they do place yellow disposal bins in various parts of the city. And then I saw that on Twitter, they told the Victoria Park Twitter account that they're not allowed to place them in the park because it's a public place. So I'm not sure why they can't do that. But I called the city. And the city, anybody from the city, I called three different numbers from the city, and they all directed me to call the region. So I called the region, and on two occasions, I just told them that there was needles and syringes that needed to be cleaned up and hung up. And two other times, I just told them that there was a large amount of needles and asked what should be done. And on both occasions, the person on the other end told me how to clean up the needles, and they didn't offer to send anybody out. And after that, I learned that you're supposed to call bylaw, and then it gets confusing because you figure you're in Kitchener, you call Kitchener bylaw, and when you call Kitchener bylaw, they tell you to call regional bylaw. And I can understand why everybody gets so confused and why people stop calling about this stuff, because you know, if you're in the park, obviously you're not on a landline, you're on your cell phone, and you don't know the numbers to everybody, and, you know, you call one person and they say, oh, well, we don't deal with that because we're just the city. You know, you have to call the region, and you don't have the number for the region, and you're on your cell phone, and you're trying to watch your kids or walk your dog or whatever. It's just very complicated. It's a very complicated process to figure out what's supposed to happen with these, and expecting, you know, residents to pick up the needles themselves is not really a good
No.
A good solution to the problem, I don't think.
No. And boy, I got to tell you, the joys of a two-tier government system, because that's what's happening, right? But Victoria Park is owned or is operated by the city of Kitchener.
Yeah.
Right? But so because it's a bylaw issue, that's why you have to call the region. Correct?
Yeah, well, I guess because it's a public health issue, gets done by the region, because Kitchener has their own bylaw,
right,
too.
So the needle program is part of Region of Waterloo Public Health. They call it a harm reduction initiative. I was just reading an article that said studies show that harm reduction programs reduce HIV infection rates and needle sharing, et cetera. By all indications, this is a good program. Except, my question is, why isn't the onus on the people that hand out the needles to have to clean them up? I mean, it shouldn't be left up to you.
And that's what I'm wondering. You know, like, harm reduction is something that's actually mandated by the Ministry of Health,
right?
So we have to do it. It's not even a choice. But there are more things that I think, you know, our local government could be doing to keep accountable on this, buying retractable needles and distributing those instead of the more regular needles that they're, or syringes that they're giving out now, like the ultra fine needles, the retractable needles. They cost, on a consumer basis, about 25% more than what, like, the regular syringes that they give out cost. I don't know what that would cost in their terms and the numbers that they're buying. Like, they're buying 300,000 needles a year. So I'm certain they're cheaper than that, but retractable needles would be a good idea, and more disposal boxes. Like, I think if you know somebody is using on a consistent basis inside and outside of a certain building, there should be disposal boxes there. You know, not every addict is going to dispose of their needles, but a lot of them, I think, would. And that would also give me, if I'm just trying to walk through the park and I see something, at least that would give me a place that I could put it instead of me having to bring containers to the park in order to put the needles in. And then I have to bring them home and find a safe disposal site for them myself. If there was a disposal site at the park,
now
it would make it a lot easier.
Right. And have you seen this problem or this issue anywhere else around town, or are you just primarily focused on Victoria Park?
Well, Victoria Park is a special love of mine, right? But no, there's certainly, you know, like near the bus terminal, near City Hall on the Duke Street side, like across the street, sometime in the parking lot of the downtown community center, like, it's an issue in all of downtown. The Market Square parking garage is really bad for it. That's not city property, but there's quite a lot in there in the elevator vestibules in there. So it is all around. But for me, Victoria is the biggest issue because that's where people and families are, and, you know, counting it because I was, you know, sending my kids to the bathroom. I have two sons, and they're old enough now that they can't go to the bathroom with me, so I'm sending them alone.
Yeah.
And then I go into the bathroom after them, and I see this, and I'm like, but I can't send my children to go to the bathroom alone because it's not safe. You know, I can teach them not to touch needles, but they're wearing sandals. What if there's one, you know, half hidden underneath the toilet in the washroom? What's going to happen? So that's why Victoria Park really became most important to me. You know, like, if you walk along the Iron Horse Trail, you'll see them off the sides of the trails all the time.
So what would you like to see happen then? I mean, you mentioned the disposable boxes, but who do you think should be cleaning up Victoria Park and other places?
Well, I think there needs to be a dedicated number, first of all, that people can call one number and that we can, you know, post in places where we know that needles are found so that it's easily accessible for people to call. I know that Aqua used to go out onto the Iron Horse Trail down near the Victoria side and help clean up the needles and use condoms and whatnot that were in the bushes back there. But as far as I know, they're not doing it anymore, but I'd love to see some cleanup crews like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I'd really like to see the city giving out retractable needles because they'd keep everybody safer. I understand why they don't want to do a one-to-one exchange program with addicts. But I do think that part of harm reduction shouldn't only be reducing harm for addicts, but it should be reducing harm for everybody, which includes me walking to the park or another person going to the bathroom at the park or in a parking garage, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, gotcha, Melissa. I want to thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on.
All right, Melissa Y, right there, a concerned Victoria Park resident. So what's the solution? I mean, we know the needle program is part of the Region of Waterloo Public Health's Harm Reduction Initiative, which is, something that is mandated by the Ministry of Health, requires all public health units to provide harm reduction programs, and they provide a $50,000 annual funding for that. That's under the price of treating one person with HIV. We know that the needle program is offered at public health offices in Waterloo and Cambridge, as well as by four partnering agencies in the community, including shelters and a soup kitchen. So who should be cleaning up Victoria Park in this case and other areas? I mean, it shouldn't be left up to the residents that are, walking their dogs or taking their kids out for a stroll. 519-570-2545, locally, out of town, 1-800-570-5715, *570 by cell. The email is eric@570news.com, and this is John in Kitchener. Go ahead, John.
Hello. I was telling your connection person that I have a newspaper clipping in my hand that the region consolidates call center with single number. And if I could give you the number.
Yeah, absolutely.
519-575-4400. And that is supposed to be 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it will connect you to a live person no matter when you call. That's what the article says here.
Well, that's interesting because I have a different number. But okay, so that one was 575-4400.
Yes.
Okay, John, I want to thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. Let's get Darren in here before a quick break. Hi, Darren, go ahead.
Hi. I used to live in Vancouver, Eric, and the parents used to have to go to the schoolyards early every day to pick up the needles and the condoms in the schoolyards.
Well, that's,
right?
Yeah, and that's not right.
And that's not right. But, you know, you're not with drug addiction, you're not going to solve it by, you know, the old way of thinking. We need a new way of thinking. And I think needle drop boxes need to be made much more accessible in much more places. They're not going to stop, right? Because they're addicted, right?
Right.
So I was going to suggest, I don't know how Vancouver dealt with it, but I have talked to people that have said back when I used to live there, I've talked to people from there, and they've said it's gotten a lot better. Maybe our officials should be contacting the Vancouver city officials just to exchange ideas and find out how they dealt with it, like, because they had a serious problem.
All right, Darren, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it. We'll look into that, into the Vancouver city of Vancouver, see what they have done. More of your calls and emails. Who should be cleaning up Victoria Park of all these syringes and used condoms and other things? I mean, a number of residents have brought up their concerns on Twitter through other ways as well. And they're concerned, legitimately so, that, you know, someone can step on this stuff. You know, it's dangerous. More of your calls and emails straight ahead on Rogers TV and 570 News.
It's a very complicated process to figure out what's supposed to happen with these and expecting, you know, residents to pick up the needles themselves is not really a good solution to the problem, I don't think.
570 Midday continues with Eric Drozd.
Well, it definitely isn't a good solution to the problem, but who should be cleaning them up? 519-570-2545, locally, out of town, 1-800-570-5715. *570 by cell. The email is eric@570news.com. Contaminated syringes along with other things like used condoms, etc., have been concerning some residents in the Victoria Park neighborhood where a lot of them have taken it upon themselves to go out every morning and clean some of this stuff up. And, you know, this is all part due to the fact that there's a needle program, of course, in the region of Waterloo, Public Health Harm Reduction Initiative, and that's mandated by the Ministry of Health, which requires that all public health units provide harm reduction programs, provides $50,000 in annual funding. Of course, the intent when needle programs started in Ontario in the late 1980s and locally here in 1995 was that people would return one for every one they received. But that meant that people couldn't get needles if they didn't have any to exchange, right? In 2009, nearly 185,600 syringes were given out and only 85,800 were returned. So that's 46%. In 2013, last year, that dropped to about a third. So what's the solution? 519-570-2545 locally, out of town, 1-800-570-5715. Star 570 by cell. The email is eric@570news.com. And this one from Kevin on the email. And Kevin says, the last caller isn't the only person dealing with this problem. I work at one of the malls in Kitchener. I'm always very safe and careful when cleaning the washrooms. But 6 months ago, I tied a garbage bag and ouch, I had a needle prick my finger. So you get the HIV test 3 months in, then 6 months in, finally got the all clear and now can kiss my wife again. I see them all over the malls, discarded in the garbages, lying on the grass. This is a real problem for the community. Two thumbs up for retractable needles. And that one from Kevin. So retractable needles, is that the solution? 519-570-2545 locally, out of town, 1-800-570-5715, star 570 by cell. The email is eric@570news.com. You can get me on Twitter at Eric Drost. And so, you know, I could see a lot of this concern, especially when you call to find out what's going on and you get the runaround, right? I mean, that's the frustrating part. You call the city, they forward you to the region. Then the region says you have to call bylaw, so you think it's the city bylaw. You call the city bylaw, then they say, no, it's the regional bylaw. So, I mean, it's just, you know, I like the idea of a dedicated number that you can call anytime you find a problem where you could speak to a live person that can help you out in some way. 11:57 here on 570 News Midday. Coming up at 12:05, Scott Barker, the co-founder of Renome, will be joining me. And this is very, very interesting software that intends to kind of link the gap between, if you ever done a home renovation, between yourself and the contractor. We'll be talking about that coming up at 12:05 on Rogers TV and 570 News.